To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy.
Here we are with another episode of Dig Deep Grow, the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. Now, today we're going to be talking about the life of the King of Pop. That's Michael Jackson. And I'll ask you the question, what do you think the King of Pop has to offer us with regards to our personal growth, our professional potential? My answer is a lot, because that's one gentleman that went through a lot in his life and under a pretty keen microscope. With us today is Zach Greenberg, who tomorrow is coming out with a new book called Michael Jackson, Inc. And this looks at Michael Jackson's life through the lens of his business side, the business side of his career. But I think that there's going to be a lot of crossover between his personal and business life, as Zach's going to share with us. Just one note, we do have a live stream going here, so I'm going to be giving away a copy of Zach's book. Again, it's Michael Jackson, Inc. And for those of you who are on Twitter, why don't you use the hashtag Michael Jackson, Inc., I-N-C, Michael Jackson, Inc. That's where I'm going to be looking for the answer to the question to get that book. So I'll be trying to monitor it, and we'll get that to that in a little bit. But right now, I'd like to introduce Zach. Zach, thank you for joining us today.
No, thank you very much for having me on.
So, Zach, I'll just start by asking you. Your last book was about Jay-Z, another pop icon. Can you talk a little about your journey from that book on Jay-Z to the Michael Jackson book? What brought you to this book?
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty interesting process from one to the other. You know, when I finished the Jay-Z book, I think I wanted to take on somebody who wasn't a step down, and you know, there aren't many places to go when you want to go up from Jay-Z. So, you know, Michael Jackson was definitely a fit for that criteria. But I think the main reason I picked Michael Jackson as the subject of my next book is that I had been covering the business of music for Forbes for a few years already when I got the Jay-Z book deal. And, you know, even as I was writing, right after I finished the Jay-Z book, but, you know, before that as well, I had been covering the business of Michael Jackson, you know, as part of my music coverage. And as time went on, I really started to notice the incredible amount of money that his estate was pulling in after he died. And, you know, I mean, just mind-boggling sums. I mean, hundreds of millions of dollars a year sometimes, and over $100 million every full year since he died. And, you know, I started to think, you know, that this isn't just a matter of, you know, of intelligently, you know, making the most of sort of the opportunities to put out, you know, documentaries and Cirque du Soleil shows after his death. This was a product of the foundations of the platform that he built during his life. You know, and the more I kind of dug into it, I began to kind of formulate this idea that Michael Jackson was somebody who, you know, despite the fact that a lot of people thought of him as, you know, kind of terrible with money, you know, toward the end of his life, and, you know, to be fair, he certainly had his struggles. He was revolutionary in business, just as he was in music, and particularly in the 80s and 90s when he made some of his biggest and best deals in his lifetime. So, I mean, if you look at some of the deals there, they really kind of paved the way for a new breed of entrepreneurial mogul musician, you know, guys like Jay-Z and Diddy.
Okay. So what I want you to try to zoom in on during this interview is to talk a little about what you came away with the personal as it opposes the professional in his life, okay? So you took it along a timeline, and I'm curious if there were certain points in his career where you took note of either, you know, he was having outrageous success because of certain things that he was doing personally, or vice versa, you know, he had influences or management that came into his sphere of influence that really, you know, turned on the heat for his career. What is your feeling about that?
I think for Michael Jackson growing up, there was not really any separation between his personal life and his work life. You know, his dad rehearsed them nonstop. They were constantly on the road, going around, you know, the area around Gary, Indiana, where he and his brothers grew up. And they didn't really have a typical childhood. It was just kind of work, work, work all the time. But I think in a way that's informs a lot of his personality going forward. Yeah, I think that he's somebody who is a perfectionist. Every album throughout his life, it seemed like it was never good enough for him, and he was constantly tweaking and, you know, making changes up until to the very end. I think that's partially a product of the fact that growing up, you know, there wasn't much separation between his work life and his personal life, and they were just so intertwined. I think that in part led to this incredible work ethic that he had.
Right. Now, do you think what influence was the greatest that, you know, made him such a perfectionist?
I think that there are a couple different influences in there. On the one hand, there's his dad, who I'm not sure I would say he was a perfectionist or not, but he was a really harsh first boss for Michael, and that was not a good thing. I think certainly in the short term, it's very well chronicled that Joseph was pretty brutal with his kids. He would beat his kids, and I interviewed him for the book, and I said, "Why did you beat your kids?" And he said, "Well, that's what everybody else was doing at the time." So, you know, obviously, that's not a tactic to be condoned, but, I think that, Joe was very intent on having his kids be out there and be on the road and continue to develop their careers. And so I think that was that intensity, regardless of the fact that it was ill-advised in many ways and executed in ways that were not positive. There was an intensity there that Joe had, I think, that Michael picked up. I think probably his most significant early mentor on the business side on the music side too was Berry Gordy. Berry Gordy, of course, chief of Motown Records, and he was really one of the most, incredible entrepreneurs of his generation in the music business or in any other business. And Michael grew up in his kind of middle childhood with Berry Gordy, and working alongside Berry Gordy in the studio and being around him quite a lot. Berry Gordy really took Michael and his brothers under his wing, particularly when they moved out to Los Angeles, and he really became sort of like a second father. And I interviewed him a lot for the book as well. And one of the things that he said is that Michael just followed him around all the time and was constantly watching him and just absorbing like a sponge. And Berry thinks that, part of Michael Jackson's business mind grew out of that exposure through some kind of osmosis where he would be, Berry would be in the studio doing a recording session with Michael and his brothers, but then he might stop to take a call and work out some kind of business deal, and Michael would be there watching and listening and kind of picking up these little things about the business that Berry was very openly sort of talking about. I think that was one of the things that really stuck with Michael from an early age and influenced him going forward.
What when you think of the rest of the Jackson family, Did you have the opportunity to interview any of the other siblings, or even people close to the family who talked about the different personalities within the family? I'm kind of curious whether Michael was very unique in his the ethic that he came out, because obviously, professionally, he was the one that really just catapulted.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Joe definitely tried to instill that attitude in all the brothers, and I did talk to some of the other brothers as well briefly for my research. But I think that obviously Michael was the one who, for whatever reason, just kind of took it and ran with it even further than everybody else did. I think that's just kind of how it turned out.
Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com.
So from the people that you interviewed, what were some of the most unique stories, or just the people who you spoke to that you felt just had a really good idea of the man, Michael Jackson?
Definitely Berry Gordy was, obviously had a great knowledge of Michael and, what he was like and who he was and what he achieved and, kind of what was at his core. There were some other great sources. Walter Yetnikoff, who was sort of Michael's next label boss. He was the head of CBS Records during the Thriller years, and he's a real character. I mean, he's really one of these kind of old school record label guys, who was spending most of the 1980s focused on booze and drugs and women, but was actually a really brilliant guy and had some great insights, into Michael and his growth and his kind of way of operating both as an artist and as a businessman. And one of the things that Walter pointed out was that Michael was obsessed with, not just making the most incredible music that he could, but he wanted it to do well. I mean, he wanted it to be recognized not just critically, but on the charts as well. That was really important to him. And he would call, when Thriller came out, he would call Walter at all hours of the night and ask him, where's the record on the charts? How's it selling? How's it doing? He was that focused on it because, it wasn't just, I want this to be the best, but I want it to be the best selling. I want it to be incontrovertible. I want there to be proof that this was the best by any metric that we can judge. And, he was certainly willing to go to great lengths to get that information. But I ended up talking to over 100 people for the book. As I mentioned, members of his immediate and extended family, Walter Yetnikoff, Berry Gordy, and a lot of people from that era, but also some of the musicians who crossed paths with him later in his career, from people who you might expect, like Teddy Riley, who worked with him in the studio, and Roddy Jerkins, likewise, to, people who maybe I think a lot of the audience might not know. He was working on music with Swiss Beats. He had traded some ideas with Pharrell. He had a couple of conversations with Nas, and those are all guys who gave me interesting kind of little anecdotes about MJ. Not to mention, in the 80s, Sheryl Crow, who toured with him on the Bad Tour, gave me some perspective of what it was like to be his backup singer, which is what she was at the time. John Bon Jovi happened to have encountered MJ at in a hotel in Japan and gave a really fascinating anecdote there. Some of these names basically are just entertainers who I've encountered in my work for Forbes, and when I would interview them, I would ask them, tell them I was writing a Michael Jackson book, and pretty much without fail, they all had some kind of interesting thing to say about MJ or some kind of encounter or revealing anecdote that they had. And it was really cool to be able to include that.
Why don't you share one or two of the ones that that really stuck out for you, either funny ones or just totally off the wall, things like that. What are the funny ones that you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's funny in sort of a bittersweet way, but I think the John Bon Jovi anecdote is a great one. He told me that in, I guess it was 1988, he was in Japan, in Tokyo, and he and his band were touring Slippery When Wet, and Michael Jackson was touring Bad, and they were both playing in, they're both playing shows in Tokyo. I think MJ was at the big stadium and Bon Jovi was at the smaller stadium. And they happened to be staying in the same hotel, and Bon Jovi got a call from Michael Jackson's manager at the time, Frank DeLeo, who said, hey, you want to come up and meet Mike? And so Bon Jovi said, yeah, sure, would love to. So he and the band go up to the top floor of the hotel, you know, off to this entire gigantic suite that Michael had reserved. And you know, Frank DeLeo, the manager, is kind of ushering them up. He's this kind of spark plug of a fire plug of a man. You know, he's sort of he was actually cast as a mobster in I think it was Goodfellas. So he's got this kind of, you know, mobster aesthetic to him, and he's puffing a cigar. He sort of extinguishes it before knocking on MJ's door and slicks his hair back. And he opens the door. And so they sit there, and Michael's not there yet, and they wait. And Bon Jovi's looking around, and Michael had arranged for the entire suite to be converted into this giant dance studio, essentially. He had all the carpeting ripped up and put this temporary wood floor on the ground so that he could practice his dance moves. You know, this is like on a Friday or Saturday night, you know, and only, I don't know how long he was in Japan, but, you know, probably not long enough that you would necessarily need to do that. But anyway, so they're waiting around, waiting for MJ. And finally he comes out and he's, you know, wearing some fantastic outfit from the Bad tour with, you know, it's all black leather and buckles and really makes an entrance. And you know, so he chats with Bon Jovi and the guys, and after a while they say, hey Mike, well, you know, we're gonna go out, but do you wanna get together later and you know, party? And he's sort of like, oh sure, let's see how it goes. And you know, so Bon Jovi and them go off, and they come back and they call DeLeo, they tell him they're back, they're ready to hang out. They're waiting and waiting, and they're just partying in their room and, you know, having a ball. And finally they hear a knock on the door, and it's Bubbles the Chimp with no MJ. Michael had basically sent down the Chimp to be his ambassador because he was wanting to stay in his room and practice his dance moves, just to get it to be totally perfect for his next show. And, you know, Bon Jovi told me that pretty much they said, all right, well, we're rock stars, and it's the late 1980s, and we're going to do what rock stars in the late 1980s should do. We're just going to trash this hotel room and get drunk with the Chimp. And they did, and they left the hotel the next day and blamed all the damage on the Chimp, and never got to hang out with Michael. But, you know, it's kind of bittersweet because, you know, it's kind of a funny story about Bubbles, but, you know, it's also, there you have Michael Jackson with an opportunity to hang out with, you know, one of his peers, and but he was so focused on his craft that he just didn't do it. He was up in his room practicing. So, you know, that was, I think, one of my favorite anecdotes that I got from the book.
Yeah, I'll ask you for one more, but first, just going to let everybody know I'm talking with Zach Greenberg, and the new book is Michael Jackson, Inc. And in a few minutes, I'm going to be asking the question for the book giveaway. So anybody who's listening right now, just send a tweet to @digdeepgrow. The first tweet that comes through with the answer to the question will get the book, and we'll arrange to get that to you. So anyway, Zach, you mentioned about his work, MJ's work ethic. Tell me, when Thriller came out, my understanding of reading a little in the book is that after Thriller, he was obsessed with trying to beat his success with that album, which, as we all know, it never happened. So talk a little about your understanding of what happened with MJ, you know, because of his of that perfectionist attitude and how that might have affected his you know, future endeavors after Thriller.
Yeah, you know, I think that after Thriller, Michael just became fixated on beating Thriller. It's that same perfectionist impulse that caused him to, you know, want to stay late in his hotel room and practice that those dance moves. He wanted everything to be the best possible, and you know that meant having everything, every subsequent product or work that he put out be that much better than whatever had come before. And you know, Thriller presented quite a problem because it was the best-selling album of all time. And, you know, by definition, it's almost impossible to beat that. And I think that as time went on, you know, and he continued to put out really good music that was very well received generally. I mean, there, you know, I think there were, you know, bad reviews here and there, but I mean, he was still putting out hits and was generally, you know, still at the peak of his game, top of the charts, all that kind of stuff. You know, all of his subsequent albums did really well. If you look at Bad and Dangerous and so on, I mean, you know, we're talking tens of millions of copies each time around, but not 100 million copies, you know, that Thriller did worldwide. So, I think, you know, with each successive album, it became, you know, even more and more of a struggle for him that he wasn't able to top Thriller in terms of, you know, making something that was better than Thriller, making his next Thriller. And, you know, I think that ate at him a little bit. And I think that was a part of the reason why he continued to sort of ramp up his spending to the point where on, you know, I guess it was on Invincible, it was something like $30 or $40 million spent on recording it, which is, you know, about the GDP of Tuvalu. That's actually true. I looked that up. So, you know, just these kind of mind-boggling sums in an attempt to top, you know, this incredible work that he'd made. So I think there's a great quote in here from 50 Cent, who really, I think, identifies with MJ in a lot of ways, because 50 Cent came in and made Get Rich or Die Trying, and then everybody was constantly holding him up to that standard. And you know, it's tough when you're constantly measured against yourself. So the quote that 50 Cent gave me was, "They put you up against yourself. If they give you an opponent, you can analyze and figure out their weaknesses and beat them. But if it's yourself, how do you win? How do you top that?" And you know, I think that's pretty apt. I think that's something that MJ certainly had to deal with, you know, as his career went on.
So at what point in his career, I mean, you mentioned that he had a lot of albums after Thriller that did very well, but there was a point where he really became much more self-destructive. Was there a point that, you know, in your interviews and talking with various people, that it became clear that there was a turning point?
You know, I mean, certainly the allegations in 93 really took their toll on him. He also struggled with painkillers, you know, throughout the latter portion of his life, which, you know, obviously took their toll. And he had, you know, a lot of people around him who were not kind of part of his original team that had, you know, been part of all of the great stuff that happened in the 80s, all these great deals that he did. And, you know, with this kind of rotating cast, there was nobody who could say no, who felt empowered to say no. And I think all these things kind of contributed to you know, to his decline. You know, I think that's what obscures some of these deals that he made particularly in the mid, late 80s and early 90s that really kind of changed the game. And that's kind of what I tried to bring back to the surface throughout the book.
Right. Okay. So the you brought up an interesting point about, you know, as a businessman, MJ made a lot of decisions against the best advice of various people, you know, who in his management team. So the question I have is, you know, on his own, was he more destructive, or you know, was he actually a genius, and he followed his instincts with regards to the music and the business?
Well, look, I think any good businessman or woman needs, you know, needs somebody to bounce their ideas off of and somebody to say, hey, you know, I think this is a good idea, this is a bad idea, what have you. And, you know, if I think anybody who is intelligent at doing business will seek a number of opinions and, you know, may continue, even if their advisors say don't do that, you know, might decide to do it anyway. Or maybe they'll say, oh, well, no, you're right. That's a good point. I hadn't thought of that. In the case of, for example, buying the Sony ATV catalog, which, you know, is probably, I would say it's the best business move that Michael Jackson made, maybe the best business move that any musician made, you know, over the past few decades, ever.
And I should say, I think it was $47 million he bought it for. How much was it?
Yeah, he bought the catalog for $47.5 million. That's the ATV catalog that contained most of the greatest hits by the Beatles and some other good stuff. And most of his advisors at the time said that was just an outrageous amount of money and that he shouldn't go for it. You know, it was just too much. And it's another nice story in there. During that meeting where many of his advisors were telling him, you know, to back off, he scribbled a note on the back of a financial statement and he passed it under the table to his lawyer, John Branca, who's now the co-executor of the estate. And the note said, actually I have it in the back of the book. There's a photocopy of it, but it says, "Let's not bargain. This is my catalog," and, you know, it all caps. And he was really adamant about it. And I think that was a case of, you know, where he was right to sort of overrule, you know, his investment committee, if you will.
And so, what's it worth now? What's that catalog worth now?
He later merged it about 10 years later. He merged it with Sony's catalog. They paid him $115 million and gave him a half stake in the new venture, Sony ATV, which is now worth about $2 billion. So I would say that he made a good call in going ahead with that one.
Yeah, that was a good one. All right, so hey, everybody, the book is Michael Jackson, Inc., and we're talking with Zach Greenberg. Right now I'm going to go ahead and pop the question. Anybody who can tweet the answer to @DigDeepGrow is going to get that book. So here's the question. As a solo artist, what was the year that Michael Jackson had his first number one Billboard Top 100 single? His first Billboard Top 100 single. What was the year? Okay, so that's the question. We'll let you ruminate on that or go Google it, whatever. Zach, I'm gonna come back to the musicians that you interviewed who had played with Michael, and talk a little. Can you talk a little about, you know, whether the, you know, what was the feeling among people who actually worked with him? Did they feel that you know, he was a taskmaster? He was a great guy to work with. You know, what was the feedback you got there?
Yeah, you know, I think that their takeaway in general was that he was a guy who just cared so much about everything he did and was a perfectionist, and, you know, and even to other perfectionists, you know, he would hold them to his exacting standards. And, you know, for example, I had a brief chat with Pharrell, and I was talking about MJ, and he said that he had actually been talking with MJ about working together, and it sent over a few tracks, and MJ was basically like, they're all right, but, you know, you got to keep working on that. You know, like, go back to the drawing board there, you know. And Pharrell said that really inspired him to kind of up his game even more. And, you know, I mean, look where he is today. So I think he definitely had that kind of influence on a lot of people.
Okay. Now, the as you mentioned, one of the most intriguing things to you was the fact that the family was able to basically, you know, bring the Michael Jackson empire out of the ashes. Talk a little about, you know, who was behind that, how was it so successful? You know, what were some of the machinery there?
Sure. So it wasn't really the family. It was the executors of the estate who, you know, had been kind of tasked with managing the finances of Michael Jackson, Inc. After his death. And, you know, that that included John Branca, his on and off again lawyer, but, you know, on for most of the 80s and, you know, pretty much the whole 1980s and then a little bit here and there in the 90s and then again at the very end. And John McClane, who's another movie shaker in the music business, who'd known the Jackson family for ages and had worked with Janet and Michael throughout his career on and off again. So, you know, those were two people who were pretty familiar with his business empire and what to do with it. But, you know, basically what happened was when he died, you know, there were hundreds of millions of dollars in debt, but there were even more in the way of assets. So they had to figure out what to do, you know, whether they were going to try to sell off these huge assets, the stake in Sony ATV, Michael's own publishing catalog, which he retained the rights to, a lot of, you know, a warehouse full of stuff that's still sitting out there somewhere in California with cars and paintings and things like that. And, you know, ultimately what they elected to do was to try to, you know, raise a lot of money through various deals, pay off, you know, the debts that were about to come due, you know, refinance some of the longer term ones into, you know, more traditional business loans. The interest rates had gotten out of control, so they were able to, what they were able to do was, you know, basically get these giant deals, one from Sony for the for a 10-year, 10-project, $250 million record deal to put out Michael Jackson-related recordings, both unreleased and sort of compilation albums, you know, going forward. Then also the This Is It documentary concert film ended up grossing, I think it was at the box office, over $250 million, and, you know, a bunch of other projects that they were able to kind of get those deals signed pretty quickly, so that they had the cash flow to be able to pay off, you know, the more pressing debts and retain the big assets, which they've done. So, you know, Sony ATV is still owned half by the Michael Jackson estate and will be passed along to his heirs, to his children, some of the proceeds will go to charity as soon as all the, you know, last remaining legal claims work their way through the system and things like that. So it's been a pretty remarkable business story, you know, one that I've been following for Forbes for quite some time, just to see how, you know, over the past 5 years, Michael Jackson has earned $750 million, and it's more than any solo act, living solo act, has made over that period of time. So just kind of a phenomenal amount of wealth generated, and really, I think, a testament to the foundations that MJ built during his lifetime.
Yeah, I think that in some regards, just, you know, for the longevity after death, we'll say, you know, I think of Elvis a little bit with regards to, you know, how long his thing has gone on. Did you draw any parallels or think a little about you know, the financial legacy that each of these guys had, or comparing them in any way?
Between Elvis and MJ, you mean?
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it was a very different kind of mindset, I think, for the two of them. You know, Elvis was somebody who signed away half of his earnings to his manager and didn't really write his own songs, and, you know, he was not necessarily so in control of his finances. You know, and to be fair, obviously MJ had his struggles later on in life, but, you know, if you look at Elvis in his prime versus MJ in his prime, I mean, you know, MJ wasn't getting kind of swindled out of half of his earnings, by his management team. He was the one saying, you know, telling them, no, you're wrong, I want to buy this Beatles catalog.
Right,
so,
right.
It was a very different approach, you know, between the two, but there are similarities there. And I know that MJ, you know, really, was fascinated by Elvis, in many ways, and looked up to him in many ways. And I think one of the things that he really wanted to do was to get into film, and, you know, like Elvis did, and to have a career for himself on both sides of the camera. And he has been, I mean, if you kind of go and look back, you know, obviously he was, well, I don't know about obvious, but to me it's obvious. He was in The Wiz, which is a musical film adaptation of Wizard of Oz, and it's set in New York instead of, you know, Kansas. Yep. And Oz. And that was kind of his debut. And, you know, I think that was, that opened his eyes to the potential of Hollywood. And then in the late 80s, he starred in Captain EO, which was a Disney theme parks only short film that was about 18 minutes long. And it was sort of like a space opera a la Star Wars, wherein Michael Jackson led a ragtag band of, you know, creatures around in an attempt to save a planet from an evil queen, and then sort of dance them to death at the end of it. And that was, you know, something that I think was a pretty big deal for him to finally be in a starring role, and to, you know, get a lot of recognition, and to work with George Lucas, who was a producer on it, and Francis Ford Coppola, who directed it. And I think for him, that was going to be the entree into, you know, into like a full-on acting career. And in the early 90s, he had a few things in development, but the allegations in 1993 just completely derailed, you know, the ambitions that he had on the big screen.
Right. Okay. Hey, so we got a couple of minutes left. I have two questions that I want to finish up with. One is that anecdote, another anecdote, you know, from the stories that you had heard. But the first one is, what do you think was the most surprising element in the book for you? You know, the discovery or part of the book that you covered, just the most surprising to you?
If I had to pick one kind of snippet that really shocked me, I think it was the amount of money that he was guaranteed for his LA Gear sneaker deal in 1990. It was $20 million, and at the time, that was $2 million more than Michael Jordan was guaranteed for his sneaker deal with Nike. So, I mean, obviously, it worked out better for Michael Jordan than it did for Michael Jackson, and Michael Jackson's shoes didn't do very well. Michael Jordan's shoes, of course, did extremely well and continue to. But, you know, the fact that he was at that level, where, you know, he was able to get a guarantee on par with Michael Jordan, I think just says everything you need to know. And what he really did was kind of open the door, for, and this is another 50 Cent quote, he said, Michael opened the door for an area that had previously been reserved for professional athletes. And then you see down the line, guys like 50 Cent and Jay-Z, going ahead and making their own shoe lines and clothing lines. It's another thing that Michael did that wasn't quite as successful as, say, Jay-Z or Diddy or 50 Cent, but, you know, kind of opened people's eyes to that possibility and kind of changed the paradigm for monetizing fame.
Right, definitely a trailblazer with regards to that. Can you think of another story that that comes to mind, just talking with the various, interviewing various people?
Oh man, I mean those were, you know, those are, I think, the great, some of the great you know, nuggets of information out there. I mean, the whole thing is packed, of course, with other ones, but I think that you know, I think those are my favorites. I mean, let me think. I think
I could put it another way and say, of the 100 people that you interviewed, what stood out to you as the, you know, the best interview that you had?
I gotta say Walter Yetnikoff was really up there. I mean, he's somebody who is just, you know, totally hilarious. And, you know, the whole time I was interviewing him, he was you know, we were having lunch and he's like, you know, sort of like your Jewish grandfather. he's like, look at you, your skin and bones. Are you going to eat that? Why are you taking so long to eat? But, you know, then he'd talk, you know, with this great kind of foul-mouthed anecdote telling of that, you know, that only a guy who's been a record executive in the 1980s can, you know, talking about, you know, how he was constantly threatening to sue, you know, this person or that person. And, you know, another one, the anecdote that I thought of initially and why I could say it is because it was a Walter Yetnikoff anecdote and it's full of expletives. So I'm not sure what the, what your policy is on that, but it's in chapter 5.
Oh, well, we're going to let everybody.
That was my other favorite one that I haven't mentioned yet.
All right. Well, maybe we'll leave that as a secret for people to look up.
Yeah.
So we're at the close of the interview. Let me ask you, where can people go to, you know, obviously you can go to Amazon or any major bookseller to get the book, Michael Jackson,
yep.
Inc. Do you have any place on the web people can go check it out?
Yeah, if you need the quick link to Amazon, just go to mjinc.co, and that'll take you right to the Amazon page.
Cool.
Express train.
Right. as we finish, let me ask you, what do you got coming next? This is early, but you're just launching your book.
Oh man, well, let's just say if I get a call from Dr. Dre or Diddy, I'll have my ears open.
That sounds great. Well, Zach Greenberg, thanks for coming on today. Really lively conversation, and I appreciate your sharing a lot about the book today.
You bet. Thank you for having me on.
All right. Take care now.
You too.